I am Kat Brooks. The presidential elections are just around the corner at this election season in the midst of the movement for Black Lives and so much other political turmoil has unearthed much about America that a lot of people would have probably rather we kept buried. Continuing with our election coverage this morning, we are joined by acclaimed writer and journalist Jeff Chang, who is also currently the executive director of the Institute for Diversity at Stanford University. And he has also recently released a new book, We Gon' Be All Right. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you for being here so early in the morning.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Transparency, this is the second time I've gotten to sit down with Jeff.
In two weeks,
which
it's
is awesome. Considering
it's awesome.
The first
it's
few months of our relationship, it was people telling us that we should know each other until we finally met. So this is good. Really good.
This is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to start off kind of sort of the way we started off the other night at CIS.
Okay.
In terms of, these are intense times for the country. I mean, I wake up right most mornings with my head sort of exploding.
Yeah.
What are the potential opportunities mm-hmm. of this time? And where are the potential pitfalls?
I think that the great thing about this particular period, in the midst of all the seriousness and the division and the rancor and the pain, right? I'm just tired. I want this to be over too. There's a bumper sticker that's out there on the road saying "Giant Meteor 2016." Let's just end it all already.
I was so confused, but that's what it
is. No, I've been seeing that for a few months, and I've been feeling like that for a few months. But you know, the opportunity I think is for folks to be able to get in place the kind of grassroots movement that we need to have, no matter who wins. To push the issues that we need to be able to push to the front of the debate here. I think that the last 8 years saw first kind of a little bit of maybe over-exuberance, right, at the beginning of the Obama presidency. And then I think what you saw was social movements gathering as we all kind of came to realize that we needed to be able to do this ourselves. So Occupy, BLM, all of these movements sort of captured people's imagination and shifted the debate. And so we need to be able to keep the pressure up on our local levels, regional levels, national levels. And that's the thing that I think we didn't have in place in 2009 when you started seeing the backlash gathering amongst the Tea Party, amongst the birthers, you know, all of those kinds of things. So that's the opportunity. I'm mostly worried, on the other hand, about the violence that may occur November 7th, November 8th, November 9th, and beyond. These folks have been roused, right? The other side has been roused.
And by these folks, you're talking about this white, organized, right-wing base.
Absolutely.
Right,
the
Trump
KKK, the white supremacists, you know.
Frenzy, right?
Absolutely. Like, they're talking now about going to Philadelphia en masse, going to Ohio en masse, like, looking at thousands of precincts. Being watchers at the polls. Like, we don't need these folks to be watching the polls in Philadelphia or Ohio or anywhere. Democracy doesn't need white supremacists trying to push folks of color from voting. And so that's the thing that I worry about. And that's the thing that I think that's keeping me up at night now.
Well, and there are white supremacist groups that are actually threatening violence against people of color should Trump lose. They're putting this out there. That's the rallying cry to their base.
Absolutely.
Which is just lightweight terrifying.
It's not lightweight terrifying. It's crazy terrifying.
Right.
I've been looking at Casey Lehman, a good friend of mine, writer who's in Mississippi, wrote, I think, on a post last night that this is like folks who are living on the coast don't understand necessarily how fired up folks are around this.
I think I saw that.
Yeah.
In other parts of the country, they've got their Trump shirts and their Trump hats and they're like, they're ready to go hard.
This is, and you know, you have people openly talking about revolution if Trump loses. What kind of revolution? I don't know. I mean, this is really
not the kind we've been talking about.
No, not at all. but that's the kind of stuff that keeps me awake at night.
There has been so much racial violence, as we're talking about, and talk of racial violence in what so many insisted on calling, you know, post-racial America. I mean, we all, I think, knew that we were not living in post-racial America. But as I think about this also being the 50th year since the birth of the Panther Party, what does that say about what, I think you call it the the crisis cycle, the loop that we've been in for 50 years.
Right, that we have, we kind of face down a crisis in every generation, that there's a crisis, there's sort of a reaction, then there's a backlash that organizes. We're kind of in that mode right now. And then there's sort of a dissipation, a kind of complacency that sets in, a softness that kind of sets in around these kinds of things. And then we're right back in crisis. So I think that in so many ways, we're not addressing the real issues. And that's why we keep on falling back into this crisis every generation. What potentially we have the opportunity to be able to do at this particular point is to leave that crisis cycle by saying, here's the issues. These are the things that we've been avoiding. The infrastructure for civil rights has been completely demolished over the last 50 years. We have become much more diverse, and yet we've become much more segregated. The indices of inequality have grown, and still the racial inequality indices are the most wide. And that's the front line that we need to be kind of approaching from, right? Racial inequality, in order to get at inequality as a whole. But there's all kinds of justifications and sort of like prevarications that we kind of dive into in order to avoid getting to that particular particular mess that we have to clean up. It's like saying, you know what? I really have to clean my house today, but I think I'll do it by lying in bed for a little while, and and maybe catching up on a few more Z's.
But I wonder if that's where America wants to be. And by that I mean, we've had sort of two political revolutions in this presidential cycle, right? On both sides. So you have the Bernie Sanders camp, right, which was to the extreme to the left, and they've of course got the Trump camp that's extreme to the right. And what it looks like where we're going to settle is in the middle again. Right? I mean, Hillary being the, I don't want to call her a balancer, but but in the middle of those two extremes, right?
And the default. It's like the status quo, right? We'll just kind of go back to that.
This thing going. Mm-hmm. So what does that say about our readiness for this change that so many of us believe we need?
Absolutely. Well, I think, and this is going to maybe revive a part of the primary elections that progressives would have liked to have avoided. But, the debate between the Movement for Black Lives and Bernie Sanders was, I think, a really, really important one. And I think that the reason it was so important was because we were sort of in the Sanders movement seeing the revival of an idea of progressivism that has really been in the mainstream of the left over the last century, right? I mean, this is the kind of New Deal type of politics adopted for the 21st century. And the thing that I think so many folks forget is that the New Deal left folks of color, particularly African Americans, out, completely out. All of the laws that we point to as being sort of the drivers of the creation of the middle class in the 50s explicitly excluded blacks. And so, when we talk about recuperating this old idea of the left and not taking into account racial justice, we end up at exactly the same kind of place that we have. And I think that was the critique that the Movement for Black Lives was making of Bernie Sanders. And so I think that particular discussion needs to continue. Again, inequality is...
We faced incredible backlash for that, right? Like,
absolutely.
Black folks were told, well, he's your ally, so sit down and shut up.
Right, right.
And this is from progressive people.
Right, but that's the same thing that happened during the 80s and the 90s. This was the basis of the culture wars, You had liberals siding with conservatives, saying that all of these folks who are fighting for racial justice are about identity politics. And that's bringing the entire left down. And I think that's... the debate that we need to kind of resolve in favor of looking at this question, right? Inequality has increased for all Americans, and yet the widest gaps are between blacks and whites. And so if we are taking seriously the facts that are there in front of us on the ground, we have to say that the solutions that would come of trying to resolve these racial inequalities will actually help everybody. Right? We have to center race in this. And that's not saying that everything is going to be about race in terms of trying to think about all of this. Intersectionality has to come into play. We have to look at gender. We have to look at sexuality. We have to look at all these different types of ways.
We have to look at class.
We have to look I think that that's it. Everybody has sort of said that class is the thing, but it's a debate between class as the only thing and class as a part, as one of the main parts of all of these other constellation of things that are happening at the same time. So intersectionality, class plus race, class plus gender, class plus race and gender, right? All of these types of things have to be seen. And people who are living at the front lines of those issues need to be taking the lead around that. And I think that that's the thing that Bernie, even in his history of being a civil rights activist, didn't necessarily see. And I think that, that's an important corrective for us moving forward.
And when I said class, too, I'm talking about the potential for there's an opportunity, maybe, right? That if we can read it, and you talk about it in your book, but this, how do we redirect the energies of these disgruntled white people who have really suffered at the hands of, you know, who don't, I've talked to Lisa Garza yesterday, she was painting this picture of people who don't have grocery stores and don't even have Walmarts, we've got Wally Worlds, right? Who lost their farm, who, right? How do we redirect their energy away from, oh, it's the fault of the black president, right? And all of his people to, no, right, at least on this front line, we're all facing the same issues and let's build power together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the main question that we have to kind of arrive at and we have to get to. You know, last summer before I went to Ferguson, I went to Appalachia. And that's exactly what Alicia is describing. You know, you're talking about rural communities that have experience a lot of the same kinds of issues that impoverished urban communities and suburban communities have faced, right? A disinvestment, a moving out of resources, right? An abandonment. And at the same time, you know, the kinds of issues that folks there are facing have to do with issues of increasing premature death, right? Rising amounts of suicides. It took the movement for Black Lives to push the media, the national media, on this particular question. But now that we've been able to kind of expose it, let's look at what the links are there and let's rebuild the movement from that kind of understanding.
It is about 7:46 in the morning. You were listening to Up Front. I am Kat Brooks here talking with one of my favorite folks, Jeff Chang, about politics in America, the 2016 presidential election cycle, and more. And we will continue our conversation with Jeff after a word from Mitch Jezerich.
Yeah, a word from Mitch Jezerich now. Yes, that's right. I'm very much enjoying this conversation, by the way, Jeff and Kat. Just quickly want to remind our folks that over the next few days, we're trying to create somewhat of a small reserve of funds to help bring a sense of stability to this radio station. That's something we haven't had, well, at least as long as I've been here. So,
and that's a long time, y'all.
but not as long as some. So I just want to say to our listeners, if you appreciate the type of show that we're doing today and these kind of great conversations, and if you haven't had the opportunity yet to make that donation to KPFA, and if you haven't had that opportunity to do it in the year 2016, here we are, November 2nd, this could be an opportunity for you right now to join this family. And you can make that contribution by going online at kpfa.org. Again, being November 2nd, a contribution to KPFA could be a great opportunity. You know, it's fully tax deductible, but you got to do it before the end of the year. It's November 2nd right now. So here's an opportunity. So just go online at kpfa.org.
I do think sometimes people forget that we are a nonprofit, right? We're not just a radio station and that we're a people-powered nonprofit. And so it is by the support of y'all that we get to continue to have conversations like we're having this morning with Jeff and on Monday with Alicia Garza and all of the hot covers that we're going to have between now and Election Day. So kpfa.org to make that donation. So November 8th, this will all be over and we'll all be
Hopefully,
oh my God, right. Well, actually, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't say that because who knows will happen in all of the bizarreness of this election cycle. Somebody's going to be president.
Yes.
What should, if you could dictate the first 100 days for either candidate, what would those 100 days look like?
Wow. I don't know that I can, well, gee, you know, I think that the first step has to be definitely some sort of healing. You know what I mean? There's been so much division and there's been so much rancor and anger that there needs to be an acknowledgement of, I'm going to flip this word, right? I'm going to reappropriate this word, of the silent majority, which is us now, right?
Right?
It's not angry white folks like in the Nixonian days. It's us. It's those of us who are tired of all of this, who have been beat down by all of this. And the healing is not this thing of like, oh, we're just going to all like kumbaya and everything is good, right? It's going to be like, let's take seriously the issues that came up during this campaign. Sexual assault, right? Racial division, scapegoating, right? Immigration, on and on and on. Economic displacement and injustice. Let's take those issues seriously. But in order to do that, let's acknowledge that we all have to be in this together. So there's that sort of thing that I think needs to happen there that I'm not convinced will happen whoever wins. And I would say that there needs to be some sort of massive rethinking of what the agenda is going to be moving forward in along the lines of what we've just been talking about, right? For me, I think that the things that I would be really most interested in would be looking at the question of resegregation, right? The fact that the divisions that we face are fueled by this unacknowledged resegregation that's happening all across the country.
But were we ever not segregated?
Well, I think that there's a lot of places that we're not. Yeah, and I think it's worth it. I think there are a lot of places that we're not, but not ever desegregated, right? But I think that the point that I've been trying to make with this word resegregation is that we did have a consensus at one point to try to move towards racial justice, however fleeting it was, however imperfect it was, and however incomplete that infrastructure was that we began to build, right, out of the 60s into the 70s and the 80s. That's all been dismantled. Fair housing laws don't get enforced. You know, fair lending laws don't get enforced. Peak desegregation happened in the schools in 1989. And since that time, we've been backsliding across all levels towards resegregation in our public schools, even as the kids who are coming up are going to be more and more and more diverse. And that's basically leading us into a situation that's going to be really untenable by the time we get to 2042 or beyond. And so I think that I would say yes and, right? Like, yes, some places never got desegregated, and some places got desegregated and have become resegregated. But the main question is, why is it that we tolerate so much resegregation or segregation, period?
Well, that I think is actually an interesting question to pose, given a lot of the narrative coming out of the movement today, which is that actually integration was not necessarily a good thing for Black people, that we actually lost keeping dollars in our communities, and we lost, you know, community structures that had been a huge piece of our survival mechanism, you know, throughout the years of chattel slavery and Jim Crow, et cetera, that at least we had these tight-knit communities. We had safety mechanisms. We had that story that all Black people tell, well, mind you, I'm dating myself, I don't know that they tell it anymore, about if I did something three blocks down the way, right, by the time I got to my granny's, not only did she know about it, but I'd gotten five whoopings along the way. So there was something about that social safety net that got broken during, you know, integration. And then there's also this other piece of the narrative that folks are talking about in terms of self-determined Black communities,
right?
And so I feel like Black folks are actually moving to a place of resegregation for lack of a better word, willingly.
Well, okay, so I want to distinguish this, right? I want to say that we need to resegregate so that, I mean, desegregate in order so that the resources can be apportioned to everybody in an equal and just kind of a way, okay?
Okay.
I certainly am absolutely sympathetic to the arguments around being able to maintain self-determination, the sort of for us, by us type of ethic, right? I mean, I'm from a community of color as well,
right?
And questions of appropriation, but even more exploitation and extraction come up in culture all the time. But these are also real things in terms of thinking about like the kinds of economic structures that have been set up during this time. I don't think that we're completely analogous to Jim Crow days in that regard.
Mm.
I think that things are a lot more mixed up. But what I'm saying is from a national point of view, we need to be able to free up the resources so that people can all start from the same kind of a place. That's the utopian kind of maybe view of things. And within that, there's a whole bunch of room to get into the nuance of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm motivated by the fact that that we seem stuck between colorblindness and wokeness, but that we haven't really moved too far from the colorblindness kind of aspect of things. And
what do you mean by that, colorblindness?
I mean that the idea of being post-racial, that we don't see race anymore, right? Like, we're all Americans together. And from a personal point of view, that means that you're not necessarily seeing me in my full humanity, right? If you are going to tell me, Jeff, I don't see you as a Chinese Hawaiian, I just see you as a person, then I'm insulted because you're not seeing who I feel I am, you know? So that's a personal point of view, but it's translated into hard policy so that any kind of attempt at racial justice is only seen in terms of non-discrimination, right? That it's only about enforcing colorblindness. And that doesn't help us to get to the point of where we can talk about policy that has been, that would remedy the fact that people were denied resources specifically because of their race all of these years. We have to be able to get at that. And so that's what I think I would like in the best of all possible worlds if we had like a dream kind of, you know, administration coming into place. That's what I would have liked to have seen happening.
And just in our last couple of minutes, I found it interesting. It seems that a lot of the ballots a lot of the measures on the ballot, at least locally, are reflective of fights that have been happening in the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got stuff about housing. We have stuff about policing. And I don't know, maybe even just a few years ago, I would have thought some of these things were a slam dunk, right? Because we knew that we lived in these progressive, radical communities, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley. But the demographics are changing,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. We've got a new population. What do you think that could? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what do you think that potentially means for things, you know, more progressive things on the ballot? And how do you think that shifts maybe organizing strategy moving forward?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah, I know. You only have like a minute and a half to answer it. So
thanks, Kat.
Be pithy. Be pithy, Jeff. Be very pithy.
Okay, I don't know. To be continued.
Right on. We've been talking to Jeff.
Oh, we got a lot of time.
We got a lot of time. So now, Jeff, you gotta finish that
wow.
one. Changing demographics and organizing strategy.
And organizing strategy. Wow. That's a tough one. That's a real tough one. I think that there's... This could be the first election in which we see, you know, what's been happening in terms of resegregation in the East Bay kind of coming to light. And I mean, San Francisco's kind of already done in that regard.
Yeah.
And I actually don't know what it means in terms of voting patterns. I would hope that folks would be voting their conscience and not their stereotype. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that as we move down the line, we're we're going to have to definitely be centering working class folks in all of these different types of struggles, and continuing to kind of make the appeals to folks who are, say, homeowners when we're talking about renting, or folks who are not in the public school system when we're talking about public schools. We're going to have to make those kinds of appeals based on their values.
Right. And support those folks that are standing their ground in their communities, right?
Yes.
And holding space.
Amen.
for
yes.
those of us who've, who, yeah. Okay, now.
Who was that?
That was Jeff Chang, co-founder of Culture Strike and Color Lines, the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University, all around fly guy, and he's released a new book, We Gon' Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation. Thank you for joining us this morning,
thanks so
Jeff.
Much for having me, Kat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Kat. Great verbal volley there, exactly at the end. But the whole thing was deep. I mean, that was pretty incredible. My friends were... down to our final minute here, and I just want to remind folks that over these next few days, we're going to be trying to raise a little bit of money for this listener-sponsored radio station to try to put us on firm ground here as we move past this November 8th election. I think to have really important conversations like we just had with Kat and Jeff. And what we're asking you to do is to make a contribution online, really whatever you can afford. It'd be a $5, $10, $15, $100, $1,000. You know, for some people, $1,000 is like a $10 pledge to others. So whatever is appropriate for you, help keep us on the air. Help get us on firm standing here as we move into a really important moment in time for this country and for our community. So hope you'll do it by going online at kpfa.org.